Yes, the Veterans Tap Dance Administration proudly takes you forward into the past.
May the 4th, 1970. Four dead in Ohio. Next up on FM, Dr. Gregory Payne, author of Mayday, Kent State.
It was the first time that our nation had experienced a national student strike. Over 480 schools shut down after Kent State. We haven't seen that occur since. Arthur Schlesinger looks at Kent State as the beginning of the end of our involvement in Vietnam. I think it was also, it marked a watershed in terms of student activism. And I think probably more importantly, at least from my perspective, if you look at H.R. Halderman's book about his days in the White House, he indicates that Kent State was the beginning of the downhill slide into Watergate. I think if we think of that entire era, we can look at it, according to William Scranton, chairman of the President's Commission on Campus Unrest. Mr. Scranton characterized that era as the most divisive our country had experienced since the Civil War. And I think we can look at Kent State as actually a culmination of all that polarization that was going on, simply because you had a president who was exacerbating the tensions and the polarization to more or less rally the people around his Vietnamization plan, which at that time was, of course, including Cambodia. We were incurring or invading, whichever word you want to use. You had a vice president the week before who I think was setting the tone, and I would imagine there are listeners out there who would agree that he was somewhat the hatchet man, who told a group of Spiro Agnew, yes.
Household word.
Yes. Yeah. He told a group of college presidents in the South the week prior to Kent State that the next time they see a group of students waving anti-war protest signs and causing problems on their campus, that what the presidents of these colleges should do is, quote, just pretend that they are wearing white sheets or brown shirts and act accordingly. You also had a governor coming on to the campus at Kent State, and I think this is very, very significant. A governor who I might add is still the governor. He was reelected. Governor James A. Rhodes, who was involved in a primary for the U.S. Senate to be held the following Tuesday, behind in the polls, but nonetheless taking the cue of the national administration and looking at students as the real scapegoats. I think students, of course, were primarily the ones who were the anti-war protesters. They were the ones fighting that war. And Rhodes came in and said, quote, what we have here at Kent in terms of the people causing trouble are the worst type of people we harbor in America. They're worse than the brown shirts and the night riders and vigilantes. And then the governor pledged, we're going to do everything we can, quote, to eradicate the problem at Kent. We're not going to deal with the symptoms, we're going to eradicate it. I think with this type of tone being set by leaders, state and national, and the local leaders at Kent too, I think can be characterized by, and this is not just my own view, this is the FBI report, the President's Commission, and various other views, tremendous overreaction on the part of the local officials in bringing in the National Guard.
Part of the whole movement back then, the anti-war movement, was considered to be very leftist-leaning. Whether that was true or not, it probably was in instances, definitely was in instances. But part of the battle cry, or part of the message was that what you're fighting here in this movement is America's traditions, really. And along with America's traditions goes family, church and family. And if your parents didn't go along with you, then your parents were supposed to be your enemy. So when the event occurred that some kids got killed, that was a lot of people's attitude. Oh, some kids got killed, you know, they got in trouble. You know? They asked for it.
I think that's a very good point to bring up, and I think one of the myths that's going to be cleared up is, first of all, even if we looked at what we've talked about, the leftist group, if we looked at the leftist group as more or less deserving it, the four students who were
not saying that there weren't ultra-rightists involved.
I think that we definitely had those people in national offices at the time, but nonetheless, I think if we look at the four students, you can see four honor students. You can see students going to their classes, one circumventing the entire demonstration, trying to make sure that she wasn't involved, and only at the very last moment, at the right time, wrong place, Sandy Scheuer walked across a parking lot 300 feet away. Bill Schroeder, an ROTC honor student, shot while he was in a prone position, shot in the back over 300 feet away. You have all of these students honor students. Of course, if you look at the guards' argument that they were surrounded, that they were, quote-unquote, forced to fire, the FBI, even with the revelations as of last November, that President Nixon directed J. Edgar Hoover to, quote, go out and find information to support the guards' view, and Hoover, quote, believing that the guard or that the students got what they deserved, end of quote. Even the FBI report, when it did come out, and I include sections of that in the book, indicated that the guards' self-defense argument was, quote, fabricated subsequent to the event. I think this is very, very important because, as it clearly shows, we had an administration that took a particular side on this issue, and what you have is years of a real cover-up and of an obstruction of justice. NBC issued a statement back in 78 where they discovered a secret memo by President Nixon's chief, our domestic advisor, John Ehrlichman, to the Justice Department in 1970 at a time in which investigations were still occurring. And the president had told Ehrlichman to, quote, direct the Justice Department that there will be no federal investigation of the incident at Kent State. Now, this is the chief law enforcement officer of our land making this decision before any of the investigations had determined anything. But I don't think for a popular opinion being well orchestrated by these leaders as well as the administration, they didn't need an investigation to know who was at fault. I think one of the reasons, too, that it's so significant, especially for the younger listening audience, of course, we've heard, and being a professor at Occidental College in Los Angeles, I've been hearing for the last 5 or 6 years the students aren't active, they're very apathetic. I think this will change a great deal when we have the draft being reinstituted. We also have a very conservative administration in Congress, or in Congress as well as the White House. I think one of the problems that I have right now, and why I think, even though some people have said, isn't this a terrible time for it to come out, i.e. right after the hostage release, right after what we might call a patriotic feeling, I look at looking at Kent State as a patriotic requirement, because to me, this country, you can't say dissent without saying America. This is really the foundation of our country. Mm-hmm. And what we have at Kent State, if you look at it, and look at the facts, you can see a real questioning of certain beliefs that we have always looked upon as definitely a part of the American life. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, justice being pursued after a situation like this occurs, and we see this not happening. So I think it's very important for young people, because of the current situation, and especially with possibly moving into the Middle East or other areas, that they see what can occur in a divisive conflict such as this. But again, I want to stress, I also think that it has a message to state and local and national leaders in terms of their responsibilities to try to be conciliatory and understand both sides. This is a democratic society we live in, rather than trying to more or less crack the whip to popularize their particular viewpoint.
Describe that day. What happened? What was going on in the United States? What was going on that campus?
Well, if I can go back a bit just before Monday, the date was April 30th, 1970.
Okay.
A country that had just elected Richard Nixon 2 years prior, and some of whom had voted for Nixon because he had, quote-unquote, a secret plan to end the war, had experienced a period in which some people believed that his Vietnamization policy was working. Alison Krauss, who would be a fatality at Kent State, had arguments with her father because she felt that Arthur Krauss, who lives in Pittsburgh and is a corporate executive with Westinghouse, was not giving Nixon a fair chance when he said he's not winding it down. But in 1970, on April 30th, I think what you had was many people coming to the realization that he was not winding it down. Ron Rednauer, who of course has done a great deal of investigation with the My Lai massacre, came out with an article this summer which indicates that the administration for many, many months had been, of course, widening the war, and there was even a what they called a plan within the Pentagon, which Mr. Rednauer calls garden plot. There was a garden plot plan in which they were going to handle dissent, and they were going to do this through the National Guard. And they anticipated once the Cambodia incursion, which had actually occurred prior to this, or invasion, I think that's a better term, much more correct, once that were announced publicly, that there would probably be a tremendous outcry, and there needed to be some type of a symbolic event. Now, what I don't want to indicate that I feel that Kent State was selected and they intended on killing four people. There are individuals who have studied the incident that would argue that. Mm-hmm. I would rather speak directly to what the facts support. On Saturday evening, a very controversial event occurred after several attempts by the students as well as others on the in the commons area. The ROTC building was set on fire. Strangely enough, none of the campus police who were on duty and waiting in a parking lot attempted to even keep the demonstrators from burning the building. None of the city police came on campus to keep them. So it was actually, as many students said, it was like they were giving it to us. It's important to note that some of the ammunition had been moved out of the complex earlier that week, and that the building was going to be razed later that spring, and the university actually, through the burning of ROTC, made some money on an insurance policy. To make a long story short, even though the university was never notified, the guard appeared on campus. The university was completely perplexed and surprised when suddenly you had armed personnel carriers bringing National Guard onto the campus. On Sunday, Governor Rhodes came in, made his very divisive speech in which
Sunday,
he said,
the date was
May 3rd, 1970. Tempers were beginning to subside somewhat. There was a fraternal situation on campus. Guardsmen and students talked a lot. There was even some frisbee playing. There were many hardline guardsmen there, though. Unfortunately, on Monday, May 4th, 1970, you had again what had been characterized throughout the weekend as inadequate communication. The National Guard officers did not realize that at noon, the Commons area was a focal point for many students going to their next class or going to the Union to eat lunch or whatever. And what occurred was General Canterbury saw a group of students crossing the Commons. There were some students there who were going to be having a rally at noon to protest the guard, but he incorrectly assumed that everybody making this noon cross was a member of this group and ordered his soldiers, many of whom had just had a couple of hours sleep, to move out against the crowd. What they did then was moved out against the crowd and cleared the commons. And this is what everyone thought was the objective. For some unknown reason, once the guard got to the top of Taylor Hall Plaza or the Blanket Hill area, they continued their march, or at least part of them did. And I don't want to confuse the listening audience because they're not familiar with the terrain, but what you had was a situation where guardsmen went out into a practice football field area, marched right into a fence. General Canterbury, the officer, was with them. It was a very, very ridiculous move. It's been criticized by the FBI, the President's Commission. Then they started marching back toward the Commons area, and everyone thought the whole thing was over. It was at this time, as I said, Sandy Scheuer, who had been in a dormitory waiting, walked across the parking lot. The guardsmen were walking back toward the commons area where they were. And students actually started walking. If we look at some of the photos, they're carrying books and starting to continue to walk to their classes. Bill Schroeder started walking toward his car. Suddenly, even though the guard was unimpeded in their march back, suddenly a group of the guardsmen, and some of these guardsmen are pictured in a huddled position prior to this, when they get to the top of the Blanket Hill, they spin around 180 degrees, all in the same direction, take about 8 steps back to where they can get the parking lot within their vantage point, and shoot for 13 seconds, 64 rounds of ammunition, killing 4 students, wounding 9 others, including Dean Kaler, who's paralyzed for life. Now, their argument is that they were surrounded and forced to fire. Yet, if we look at the evidence, the guardsmen who turned around and actually walked back and shot for 13 seconds didn't shoot at the students who were closest to them. And these students, again, I want to stress, were walking to their class. There was no one throwing rocks at that time.
The names of the people who died at Kent State.
Allison Krauss.
From?
Pittsburgh. William Schroeder from Lorain, Ohio. Sandy Scheuer from Youngstown, Ohio. And Jeffrey Miller from Plainview, New York.
The guard turned and shot 4 people dead, and then what immediately happened? Where did the guard go after that? What happened?
That's an interesting situation, too. After the guard turned around and fired, John Filo indicated that for at least a minute to 2 minutes, there was absolute silence. People could not figure out what had happened. And still, it took a couple of minutes after people started looking around to realize that this had occurred. A group of people immediately started gathering around Jeffrey Miller. He was the most obviously wounded, a tremendous wound in his head. Alison Krauss was ducking behind a car at the time, and the M1 bullet ripped through both doors and ripped through the seat, ripped through Alison Krauss. As the guard was leaving, one of the guardsmen, who has been identified, looked back at the students who were gathered around and threw an M60 practice grenade over Miller's body, and it fragmentized, and there were a lot of plastic bits scattered throughout the air, injuring many students and cutting them either in the face, and a couple people had eye wounds. After that, the guard marched back to the area where they had started, and then there was a tremendous situation where many of the students were almost in a frenzied fit. They were realizing what had happened, and I might say many of the guardsmen were also realizing what had happened too, many of the younger guard. They were pulling off their gas masks, and it was becoming very evident that both sides were getting very, very upset. One thing I do want to clear up, of the 28 who turned around and fired, there's been a myth that, well, it was the young, inexperienced guardsmen, and isn't it ironical that you would have a group of protesters mm-hmm. who had joined the guard to avoid Vietnam called into a situation to quell other protesters. The ones who turned around and fired were not the young guardsmen. The majority of those 28 were older guardsmen who had had riot training experience many, many years. One of them had been a Korea War veteran, and he's out sort of in the front. So this myth that it was the young and experienced, I know that's another effort to sort of rectify the situation, but that simply doesn't mesh with the facts. So they went back, and the guard was on one side, the students were on the other, and had it not been for Professor Glenn Frank, who was a professor of geology and a faculty marshal that weekend, pleading not only with students, but with guardsmen who were prepared to march again, there would have been not four, but probably 40 or 50 people killed that day. But with a very, very passionate speech, not only to the students, but to the National Guard, and the officer in charge told Professor Frank, these kids are going to have to find out what law and order is all about.